Welcome to Writer Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis. You can check out my books and social media at mindymcginnis.com and visit the Writer Writer Pants on Fire blog at writerwriterpantsonfire.blogspot.com. Today's guest is historical fiction author and longtime podcast supporter Alyssa Palumbo, author of The Violinist of Venice and The Most Beautiful Woman in Florence. Alyssa joined me to talk about how she went from aspiring to published author and an early attempt at querying a novel that wasn't ready yet. I want to add that the audio in this episode is not perfect. I think we had a bad internet connection. It does seem to improve, so please bear with us for the first few minutes. So I always ask my guests about their query journey and their agent hunt process. So tell us about how you went from aspiring to published author.
When I was 18, I queried a novel that was historical. It was awful. It was bad in like every possible way that a novel could be bad. And I queried a bunch of agents. I didn't get any bites on it, not surprisingly. And it's kind of embarrassing, but I'm glad that I did it because in doing that, I had to basically learn about the query process and learn about agents and learn about what they did. So fast forward to, I don't know, 4 or 5 years later, I had the manuscript Violinist of Venice. It had been through 3 drafts, and I had revised, and I had had critique partners read it and everything, and I was ready to query. And the second time, I had much better luck. I queried, I don't even remember the total number of agents. I sent out a bunch of queries. I remember my agent that I signed with, Brianne Johnson, she was my first choice agent. She responded to my query in like half an hour and asked to see the first 50 pages. And then a couple weeks later, she wrote back and asked for the full manuscript. And then I think 2 days later, she emailed to set up a call. So really, that process only took, I think it was like 3 weeks from the time I started querying that book to the time that I actually signed with an agent. It all happened pretty fast.
So you had one book under your belt that was shelved then?
That one, there might be certain like scraps of that idea I do something with later. That one will never see the light of day. I had written other books too. I think I had probably written 4 or 5 total before The Violinist of Venice, which was my first published novel.
That's about par. From the other conversations I've had with other authors, I know that my first published was my 5th. Actually, The Female of the Species was the first book that I ever wrote. The finished product that you see on the shelves today has literally nothing in common with what I wrote when I was in my 20s. Yeah. It was a manuscript that I revisited. Just one glance told me that it had no business being put, even in front of beta readers. It was terrible. And that first book, that first few, I always tell people when I do author visits, they're going to be bad.
But at the time when you're writing it, you sort of think, oh, this is going to get published, and no.
I think it's a necessary fiction that you tell yourself. If you were writing it thinking, this will never get published, I'm wasting my time, you wouldn't do it in the first place.
And I think we've all heard sort of those like unicorn stories of people who they sat down and they wrote the first novel they ever wrote and it got published, but that's definitely the exception and not the rule.
So you said you had to learn all about the query process. What resources did you rely on?
There's a big book, and it's called Writer's Marketplace. Most libraries have it. You can get it at probably your local library, but it has a lot of agents listed. It usually gives their website and what genres they represent. So I sort of paged through that book to look up agents that I wanted to query. In terms of actually writing the query letter, I read a ton of blogs online from established and published authors who sometimes shared their query letters or shared tips and that sort of thing. I actually have a book as well about writing queries that I bought, and it has information on querying agents, but also if you're sending a pitch to a magazine for an article, that sort of thing. So I probably kind of over-researched it a little bit. By the time I wrote my query letter, I was like, oh, I got this. There's a ton of blogs and forums and all kinds of stuff out there and podcasts like this one that can help you sort of learn the steps of the journey and give you sample queries and all that sort of thing that is really, really helpful.
I relied very, very heavily on the Writer's Market. They were so helpful to me. This was back in 2002, 2003. I have old writer's markets that there'll be a little notation in the margin. It'll say, you know, I sent it on this date. I got my rejection on this date. Very rarely is there anything more positive written beside it.
I kept a big Excel sheet of here's the agent I queried. Here's the date I sent it. I put the date, if they asked for more pages, I put the date that happened. And then, of course, the date of the rejection. And I mean, I think I did get in that sort of 3 week span before I signed with my agent, I got like 13 rejections, I think, 12 or 13. And I did have a second agent that was also interested, but they kind of weren't ready to make an offer. So I said, well, I do have an offer.
I used Query Tracker because they offer, I believe in the paid version, you are able to track who you've sent to, when you sent it, and if they requested pages. Mm-hmm. That may even be available in the free version. I would have to check, but I found it invaluable. I was querying in the beginning, back when you printed out your pages and mailed them. That was painful, especially if you would get a full request. Not that I ever did. You would get partial requests and you would print off 25, 30 pages. And there's ink in it, and there's paper in it, and you mail it. And if you want it returned to you, you have to pay for that postage as well. And you would get some money involved.
By the time I was querying, they just wanted everything electronically. So that made it easy.
At first, they were leery about opening up to that because there was a specific amount of work involved in printing out and doing an SASE. And so it already filtered out some people that were like, I don't want to do all that work. At the beginning, agents were a little leery about accepting email queries for that reason, because it kind of opened the floodgates. But of course, you know, the march of time changed that. If someone did specifically only ask for a snail mail query, I think that would set off alarm bells for me about how accessible they want to be to me as an agent. I remember when they opened up to emails and I was like, oh my gosh, this is so great. I can send 10 queries in a minute and I can get my rejections back in two.
And I don't know if you did this, but like I would get a rejection in, I would feel kind of down about it, obviously. And then I'd be like, well, I'm going to send out another one. And so I sort of kept building, like every time I got a rejection, I would send a new query to someone else to sort of make sure I had lots of lines in the water, so to speak.
I always try to have at least 10 out. Oh, I want to say too, because you mentioned that with your book that did end up published, The Violinist of Venice, you did still have rejections on the query that you had put the work into, and you had a good book. And I think that that's an important point, because with Not a Drop to Drink, I was only querying that book for, I believe, a month. I was not querying it for long, and I got picked up fairly quickly with that book. Having suffered through triple-digit rejections for the books before that, I was still getting rejections. It wasn't a across-the-board, everyone loves you now. I believe it was something like 60% rejected. I had 30% page requests. And then from those page requests, I had 80% rejection and two offers. I just think it's important to point out that even when you've got a query that works, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are going to achieve success.
I read someone else wrote something to this effect, and I don't remember who it was. They basically said something to the effect that agents and editors, to take on your book, they have to really, really love it. Think of all the books that you read that you like and you enjoyed them and you liked reading them, but you didn't love them. That's sort of the difference in what is going to make an agent sign you or what's going to make an editor take your book, is they have to really love it and be passionate about it.
Your agent and definitely your editor, they're going to be reading your book 10, 15, 20 times. You are sick of your own book.
Yeah, by the time like I read the past pages, which is sort of the last step, I'm like, get this out of my face. I can't even look at this anymore. Yeah, when you think about how many times your agent, again, and your editor are going to have to read it, they have to really, really like it. They probably, sometimes they might even like it more than you do.
I don't know about you, but I never read my finished product, because you're always going to find something you would change. Have you ever had anyone point out a typo in your book?
No, not so far. I had a panic moment not too long ago because I was doing an art giveaway for The Most Beautiful Woman in Florence, and I noticed a mistake, and it was kind of like a logistical mistake, and I was freaking out because I couldn't remember if I had caught it in the past pages. And I just got my finished copies of the book, and I checked, and I caught it, and it was fine. But so far, if there are mistakes, nobody has told me about them, but there probably are a couple.
There's a mistake in the hardcover of Not a Drop to Drink. A person who is dead is given a line of dialogue. And I have had so many people tweet me. They're trying to help, but it's like, yes, I know. My mother caught it. My mother was the first person to catch it. It serves to show, though, that no matter how many people, professionals, whose job this is, that go through this manuscript, there's always something gets through. Just about every finished book has a typo of some type.
Because it's all people at the end of the day. Like, you're always subject to that human error because it's always a person going over the text.
There's usually something a little bit, I don't know, I think I'll use the word coy about the mistake that many people miss it. So, for example, the mistake in Not a Drop to Drink is that the person who is dead is being spoken of, and their name is very similar to the person who is alive and speaking. Somehow right. Your brain, like, auto-corrects it, I guess. And so my editor misses it. All of my critique partners who are published authors, they miss it. I miss it. Copy editors, which usually two of them go through the finished text, they miss it. And then, you know, my mom catches it, so.
My mom would totally catch that, too.
Yeah, my mom caught it. It was great. She called me at 8 a.m. on a Saturday, and I just assumed that someone died, because why else would you call?
Right, at 8 a.m.
But actually, that's true. Someone had died, now that I think about it.
Continuing with the amount of research involved with writing historicals, from travel to reading to art and music, how Alyssa immerses herself in the world of her characters, as well as the shifting social perception of feminine beauty from age to age.
You write historicals, which requires a tremendous amount of research. So share with us some of your methods for getting into the world of your characters, because I know that you just, from speaking with you when we were in Buffalo together, I know that you really go fully immersive.
I really like to travel to the place where the book is taking place, if possible. That's a big thing for me, to sort of see the city or the place where this is all taking place. And in certain cases, some of the actual buildings or literal rooms where things are happening. If I can do that, I like to do that. So with my second book, The Most Beautiful Woman in Florence, and with my most recent book that I just finished, I was able to do that. So that's really great, and that's really helpful to me. But I mean, I do obviously a ton of reading, biographies of people involved, books about, you know, like for instance, the book that was set in Venice, I read a few books about just the history of Venice from its founding to the present. For The Violence to Venice, I researched Vivaldi and his music. Basically, you read anything you can get your hands on about your period and about the people that are involved in it, what life was like at that time period. You do need to do a lot of reading, but it's not only that. There are other things that you can and should do. So another thing that I find really helpful is to look at artwork from the era that I'm writing about, because not only, you know, might this be something that someone might have hanging on their wall, so it gives you that sort of detail, but also it gives you a really good sense a lot of times of the clothes that people wore, how they did their hair, what kind of jewelry they wore, especially like for instance with The Most Beautiful Woman in Florence. Something that happened in art at that time is that they would paint religious biblical scenes, like the manger scene for instance, and they would paint in the patron who's paying for the painting, and it would be sort of in this contemporary Tuscan setting with contemporary people from that period, and you would see what they were wearing and what they looked like and that sort of thing. I look at maps, I look at photographs of what that place looks like now. If I get to go there, I take a lot of pictures so that I can refer back to them later. I listen to some of the music from the era if I can, like for instance with The Violence to Venice, there was a lot of that because the story was about music. Anything you can find that is related to that period. Oh, and if you can find museums that maybe have furniture from that time period or musical instruments and things like that, you can actually go and look at. That's always really helpful too. Again, it's a lot of reading, but it's not just that.
Tell us a little bit about the setting and the characters that are in The Violinist of Venice so that people can get a little bit of a grip on what the book is about and how deeply invested you were in your characters and their lives, both fictional and biographical.
Sure. So The Violinist of Venice, the premise is that it's told from the point of view of a woman named Adriana D'Amato, who is a fictional character. And the book starts where she goes to the house of Antonio Vivaldi, who is obviously a famous composer, but at the time he was more famous for being a virtuoso violinist. And Adriana, her father has forbidden her to study music. She studied it when she was younger, but he doesn't really feel it's appropriate for women to study music. So she sort of sneaks out to find Vivaldi, and she wants him to give her violin lessons because, you know, he's sort of the best that there is. So he agrees, and they have lessons together, and as it progresses, they fall in love, which is a problem because Vivaldi is a priest. In the meantime, Adriana's father is trying to sort of make economically and socially advantageous marriage for her. So she's got that to deal with. My main character being fictional gave me a lot of latitude in the sense that I could have her life, in most instances, take whatever direction I wanted it to. Obviously, with Vivaldi, there are certain things we don't know about his life, which is helpful, but there are certain things that we do, and we know that he was doing this thing at this time. So that aspect of his character, you know, all had to conform. There's a few things that happen in the course of their relationship where he goes someplace or does something. And that was something that really happened that I had to make sure that I included in the story. Throughout the second half of the book, it is much more about Adriana. So again, it was really freeing because I could explore the different aspects of Venice at that time that really interested me and get her to experience some of that too, in a way that I think made a pretty good story.
I want to talk a little bit more about actually traveling to your destinations, because I find that fascinating and very freeing. I think that would be wonderful. I actually set Not a Drop to Drink at my own house. Diana Gabaldon, who wrote the Outlander series, which I always point out to people now that I was reading those in the 90s. Thank you very much. She did not visit Scotland until I believe she was writing the third book. She did not go there. She had never been there. And she was doing her research before the internet existed. So yeah. She didn't have Google Earth. She didn't have access to any of the tools that we have today. And she was reading encyclopedias. She was looking at travel books. She was going to pages to put together Scotland. So she was really doing a lot of that up to the elbows research, and she nailed it. I find that so fascinating that she's able to build a world that is a real world, and she did such a great job just doing research. And not even with the tools that we have today, she was able to execute very intricately a world that she had never visited. When I was writing In a Handful of Dust, my characters are walking from Ohio to California. I have never, at that point in my life, I had never been very far out west. Mm-hmm. And I was using Google Earth, and I was using, at that time, Google Maps had the little yellow man that you would drag and drop, and you could spin him around and get a 360. So I was doing that and describing what I saw, and it was a fantastic resource for me in viewing and describing things that I had never actually seen before. But it really made me appreciate that kind of research for writers that didn't have those tools. So because you do travel quite extensively, do you find that you pick your destination based on your research needs? Or have you sometimes been traveling and a destination inspires you to write a story while you're there?
Both, actually. Both have happened. So with Violinist, I started writing it. I just had this idea and I had to start writing it. And I got to a point where I knew that I needed to go to Venice in person, because Venice is this completely crazy place and it's not like anywhere else in the world. And I just really wanted to see it for myself. You know, by that point, I had sort of done all of the book research, and it was really just, what does it really look like there and how do people get around there and that sort of thing. So actually, when I was on that trip to Venice for Violinist, I also went to Florence at that same time, mostly because my mom was traveling with me and she was dying to go to Florence. And I was kind of like, meh, I don't know. But she came along with me. So we went to Florence also, and I got there and I loved it. And it was while I was in Florence that first time that I learned about Simonetta Vespucci, who is the heroine of my second novel. And so from that trip, that idea sort of started to generate in my mind. When I came back, I still was finishing up some revisions to Violinist to get it ready to query and that sort of thing. So I filed that other idea away. When St. Martin's Press bought Violinist, they gave me a two-book deal. So I had to, you know, come up with something for a second book. And I remember this idea that I had about, you know, it took place in Florence about Simonetta Vespucci. And I thought, okay, well, maybe this is time for that idea. So once I did start working on that, I decided as I was writing, I realized I needed to go back to Florence to see some things that I hadn't seen the first time. So then at that point I did go back, but it was being there in the first place that really sort of sparked the idea initially. If I had never been there, I don't know that I would have come up with this idea.
Once you have your real living characters, the people that are actually historical characters, how do you then build your plot around them? Because I know obviously you do have to stick to the facts when it comes to certain elements in their lives. Yet how do you do that, yet keep it interesting with a plot arc? How much freedom do you give yourself to play in between the lines?
With The Violinist of Venice, it was a little bit different because, again, my main character was a fictional character. But with The Most Beautiful Woman in Florence, Simonetta is a real person. So there are certain facts we know about her life and certain events that where we know she was there that I had to adhere to. With that said, there's really not a ton more information about her beyond those things. We have a few bare facts and that's sort of it. So with that, I could sort of build on those facts that we had and those events that we know took place. I use that as a framework to then fill in the blanks, basically. And I imagined scenes and I created scenes based on what I knew of her life and what I knew of that time period. What are things that she might realistically have been doing? What might she have been seeing? I use my vision of her as a character, write about how I thought she would behave in a certain situation. It was tricky at times. So early on in the book, she is sort of in the process of getting engaged to this guy and they're getting married. So one thing that I couldn't really confirm was where their wedding took place. I read like 3 or 4 different scenarios of where this wedding actually happened. And it was just really frustrating not to be able to know which one was correct. So in an instance like that, because it is fiction, I sort of said, I'm going to pick which one that I like best. If you are presented with conflicting information, you can sort of pick what fits the story best. You want to try not to contradict a known historical fact, but something that I did in that book was I talk about a lot of Botticelli's artwork, and it's all real artwork, but I sort of fudged a little bit the timeline in which he painted them. Like some of them he actually painted much later in his life, but I had him do it sooner so that it could be part of the story. So there's always an author's note in the back where I sort of explain that like, yes, this is the painting, like he did paint it, but it was, you know, several years later as opposed to when I showed it in the story.
And so for The Most Beautiful Woman in Venice, because of the fact that she is obviously described in a certain way to even have the title, did you know what she looked like? I'm assuming that there were plenty of portraits of her.
Simonetta Vespucci is supposedly the woman who's in Botticelli's The Birth of Venus. It's about her and how she got to meet him and sort of how she ended up in this painting. So yes, we do know what she looks like. And he painted a couple other portraits that are supposedly of her. And even if you look at a bunch of his other paintings, there's this like same woman in all of them, this same woman with, you know, sort of blonde, wavy hair. And it's clearly the same woman in all these paintings. I did know what she looked like. And one of the things that we know about her is that she really was considered at the time the most beautiful woman in Florence. She used to have men standing outside her house, like singing to her, and they used to leave flowers and they used to leave gifts. She'd get stopped in the street. There were men who would fight duels in her name because someone else said that some other woman was more beautiful than her, so they would like fight a duel about it. It was crazy. It was like she just sort of was this big celebrity figure, and she didn't really do anything except people thought she was really beautiful and they sort of went crazy over her.
There's so many parallels too, though, to today. You're attractive. Yeah. That's all you have to do.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think about in conjunction with today's celebrity culture. You are putting yourself out there to a certain extent, but how far is too far in what people expect or want from you? And then in the case of Simonetta, she was just a private citizen and people just sort of like made her into this celebrity.
Just out of curiosity, because I'm familiar with the painting, what people consider to be beautiful today, do you see differences? If she were alive today, would people think she was still the most beautiful woman in Venice? Or do we have a different, did standards change? Did aesthetics change, in your opinion?
That's a really good question. I mean, she's blonde, which is one of the first things people think about when they think of the Western standard of beauty. But she's blonde, she had light eyes, she's white on the more slender side. In a lot of Renaissance paintings, you look at these women, they're all typically a little bit, I guess, quote unquote, heavier than we would consider the ideal today. I did see online one time there was, I don't remember her name and I apologize, but there was this artist who photoshopped a bunch of famous Renaissance paintings. She photoshopped the women in them to conform to our modern standards of beauty and made them thinner and, you know, made their breasts bigger and things like that. And it was really interesting. With Simonetta, I think that based on the painting, I think she certainly was a beautiful woman. And I think that there are certain overlaps in our Western ideal of beauty that she had that we still have today. But I think there have been shifts too.
And I do think that we are shifting back towards a more healthy body image. I am definitely seeing a change away from the Twiggy look, which was big in the 70s. And then we shifted again, and then we shifted again, and now we're shifting again. So I think it's normal. It's natural. There's always a cycle. I do think it's interesting when you look at all of Titian's women are larger women.
I have a postcard of one of his paintings is called Venus with a Mirror. And she's sort of, she's naked and she's sitting in front of the mirror looking at it. And she, by our standards today, she is quite heavy. And I actually keep this postcard next to my mirror in my bedroom to remind myself that beauty is subjective. Like sometimes
absolutely
I look at it and think that, you know, 500 years ago, this was the highest level of beauty. And nowadays people would say, oh, she's fat. They would call her fat. Keep it there to remind myself that these things are always changing. I agree with you. Yeah. We're totally moving away from that standard of super skinny, white, blonde as the ideal. And our concept of beauty is, I think, becoming more diverse. And I hope it certainly continues to move in that way.
I'm reading a novelist right now named Dawn Powell, mm-hmm. who wrote in the 20s and the 30s. Mm-hmm. And her books are set during those time periods. It's so interesting to me because the men, when they speak to each other about women, when they say that someone has a nice figure, it's because she's bigger. They don't like the skinny women. And it comes up. They'll be like, oh, look at her. She's too skinny. Skinny was an insult in like the 20s and the 30s. It's so interesting to read because the men were just like, oh, look, she's skinny. And that was not a good thing to be in the 20s and the 30s. And there will be women having conversations with each other about how they're trying to gain weight because they want to be attractive. I just found it so refreshing.
Along those lines, too, I remember a couple years ago, I was at the Smithsonian with my friend. I think it was the Museum of American History. But one of the things they had on display was these sort of pinup postcards that they sent to the troops during World War II to sort of keep their morale up. And we were looking at these women, and they were, again, today they would be considered heavy. They would be considered as not conforming to the current standard of beauty because they were not the model skinny body type. And I think it is refreshing to see that these things do change. And of course, ideally, we would want to have a standard of beauty where everyone's body type is considered beautiful. And, you know, I hope we get there someday. But yeah, it is refreshing to know that it hasn't always been a certain way. You know, there are shifts.
When we are considering our own beauty, most of the time, we're comparing ourselves to other women. We are aiming for what we think is attractive.
Right.
Instead of wondering if we're trying to attract a man or another woman, we're not actually most of the time wondering about what they will find attractive, but trying to make ourselves whatever the ideal is. And obviously not everyone is attracted to that ideal, but I think that there is, in the terms of men, in a world of masculinity, if they see that woman that everyone else says is attractive, that is supposed to be attractive, then there is a certain pressure upon them to react to that in a certain way.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And so much of the female standard of beauty is concerned with the male gaze and being what do men find attractive and sort of centering that male gaze in that way. And like you say, like if we as women are sort of looking at ourselves and asking, do I look good? Well, do I look good to who? Like, do I think I look good? Because that's really all that matters. God bless. That's all that should matter. You know, there's sort of all these little voices in your head, voice of society, of what you see on TV and in advertising and that sort of thing. It's tough to break free from that because I think you have that voice telling you that we should all look the same to be considered beautiful. But really, as long as you are happy with yourself, that's all that matters.
Lastly, Alyssa talks about the time balance of blogging as well as writing fiction, along with the different skill sets, yet interesting similarities at use in both. We also talk about the balance between blogging for your readership and blogging for aspiring writers, and where you can find Alyssa online. I want to talk about your blog for a second. Your blog has been up and running for 2 years. So as an author and a blogger myself, I'm curious to find out how other authors balance the work of blogging with writing novel-length works. Do you find yourself using different skills for each?
That's a good question. I mean, in terms of balancing, I don't know that I balance it as well as I would like to. I should probably update my blog more than I do. Sometimes I just think about, what do I want to write a post about? And sometimes I'm not sure, and I'm not sure what people will find useful. And it's nice sometimes to see, you know, certain posts might get more likes than others. And so I'll think, okay, well, maybe I should do more like that. I do want to get better about posting on my blog more regularly. In terms of different skills, I mean, I think it is because if you're writing fiction, that sort of one skill set, you're telling a story. And with a blog post, I might be talking about my process, and that's something that is nonfiction. And so I guess you write that a different way. I try to keep my blog posts a little more casual and conversational. So I guess that is a little bit of a different style of writing. There is sort of like an arc to a blog post. Like you sort of want to introduce it, and then you build up to your point, and then you close it out, and there's like a little mini arc to it in the same way that a novel has an arc, I suppose.
You're obviously, in most cases when you're blogging, you're writing nonfiction. You're writing small essays. You're writing micro essays. I find it difficult at times to pop back and forth between the two, but I enjoy blogging. It is hard to find out what people want to read about. Sometimes blog posts that I am not expecting to take off just go. And I don't know why.
The thing that I struggle with in that regard, too, is, you know, I like to talk about my process and I like to sort of hope that my blog would be a resource for aspiring writers. When I myself was sort of starting out, that was the kind of stuff that I read all the time. So I like to talk about the writing and the craft and the business aspect of publishing a little bit. But then I also sort of think like, okay, because my blog is on my official website, people coming to my website probably also have read my books and maybe they're looking for more information about the book that they just read or like some little sort of behind the scenes stuff about a certain book, because I know that when I go to an author's website, that's usually what I'm hoping to find. So I try to sort of strike a balance with that. As we get closer to the release of The Most Beautiful Woman in Florence, I'm going to do a little blog series about the different artwork that I describe in the book, and I'm going to have a picture of it in the post and sort of talk about it a little bit and talk about how it plays into the novel. Something for my readers, but something also for aspiring writers.
I struggle sometimes because my blog is very driven towards aspiring writers. That was the reason why I started it. I was trying to help people in ways that I wished I had accessible to me when I was an aspiring author, because I had all these questions. And the blog is me asking now published authors the questions that I had when I was pre-pub. So I like to have that resource out there for people, but I also have to strike a balance between my readership as well, because the aspiring authors that are coming to my blog and looking for help aren't necessarily my readers.
Right.
So I have to be trying to kind of market myself at the same time. And it's hard at times to know what that balance is and exactly how to possibly draw in new readers and at the same time keep the function that I had originally in mind for the blog to help other authors still be my focus, but at the same time, like, it has to be serving a purpose for me too. Like, I would like to turn those aspiring authors that are drawn by the content into my readers.
In a way, you're really sort of writing for two audiences but hoping to bring them together, and so you have to try and think up content that will appeal to both of those groups. You're sort of writing for two audiences in a way.
Yes, and that's very difficult at times. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I am specifically posting for one audience, and sometimes I'm specifically posting for another. Everyone, of course, is always free to pick and choose whatever they are most interested in. My stats can show me how long someone was on a page and how long they were there on average. So I'll know whether people are actually reading them or not. The clicks are nice. Clicks are great. Obviously, that's what you want. But it's more important to me that someone's actually reading what I'm putting out there, because I put time into it.
Right, exactly.
And I want people to be reading my content.
I feel this way. I don't know. Maybe you do too sometimes. But sometimes post something and I just sort of feel like I'm shouting into the void a little bit. Spend an hour writing this. Does anyone care? And maybe not. But I do have fun writing a lot of my blog posts too. So there is that. Like, it is something that I enjoy, and it's not, I'm not just doing it because I feel like I have to. I wouldn't want to read something that somebody felt like they had to write. So I always try to make sure that it's a topic that I'm interested in.
I will put a lot of work, an hour or more, into some things. And then I'll have like what I think is really good information. And I will really put some work into this and it won't really get picked up. I mean, obviously some people are reading it, but it doesn't have a lot of hits. It doesn't get any comments. And then I'll post something stupid and everyone loves it.
Yeah, you can look at like who visited the site and what they looked at. But I did sort of similar to what I'm going to do with The Most Beautiful Woman in Florence. But for The Violinist of Venice, I did this thing where I put some pictures I had taken in Venice and I described the location and, you know, how it played into the book, if at all. And like people still are looking at those. Like they're, you know, they're over a year old now and people still are coming to my site and looking at those. So I don't know if it's people that read the book that are stumbling on it, or I don't know if it's more of people find the photos somehow and they're looking at those. I don't know, but it's interesting to see, like you said, sort of what everybody really likes and what everyone's looking at the most, as opposed to, yeah, the things that you spend a lot of time thinking about and maybe outlining, and then, you know, you take the time to write it and it's kind of like, eh, nobody's really reading it.
Have you seen a decrease in... Well, you've been blogging for 2 years. I've been blogging since 2010, roughly. I used to see more people commenting. There was more of a give and take when it came to blogging there was more interaction with your readership, and I see less comments now. Like, yeah. No matter what my content is, people aren't commenting, which is fine. I don't expect everyone to take the time to make a comment, but I kind of enjoy the conversational aspects that can pop up. I'm not getting comments anymore.
Yeah, now that you mentioned that, you're totally right. I don't really get comments on the post so much anymore. I did sort of maybe like a year ago when I first started, I was getting more comments. Now what I'm finding is when I do get comments on something on the site, it's not usually on a post that I wrote, but it'll be on like my page, my like about me page or my page for The Violinist of Venice where somebody read the book and they really liked it and they wanted to let me know. And like, that's great. Like, I love hearing that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of comments on the content of the site itself, I haven't really gotten any of those of late. You're right.
I do think it's interesting how the blogs in general have become less of a conversation mm-hmm. than they used to be. Everybody comments on news articles now, yeah. which is pointless, but that's where the input's going. So why don't you tell us some of your social medias so people can find you and follow you online, and also let us know about your site and your blog and where we can find you so that people can take a look at those.
Sure. So my site is just, it's just my name, alyssapalumbo.com. My Twitter handle is Alice in Wonderland, but it's spelled AlysinWnderland. So it's a little abbreviated Great. There. And then my Instagram handle is actually exactly the same.
Cool. All right.
So yeah.
And I will be sure to link to all of your social medias inside of the post so that everyone can do an easy click and find there. And your blog is then part of your site, correct? AlyssaPalumbo.com.
So if you go to the site, you can see all the posts, the blog posts sort of come up. And then there's different pages about my different books, and there's, you know, an events page and stuff like that. So everything is right there on the site. And there are links to my social media handles on the site as well.
Writer, Pants on Fire is produced by Mindy McGinnis, music by Jack Corbel. A special thank you to fellow authors Alyssa Palumbo and R.C. Lewis, as well as patron Stephen Avery and supporter Brian Kennedy for helping to make this episode possible. If you find the blog or podcast helpful, please consider showing your support by visiting patron.podbean.com/writer, Pants on Fire and making a donation. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Writer, Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist.